meeting signatories to fulfill their obligations. On Wednesday, top Iranian security sources ruled out a step-by-step return to the deal, reiterating that Tehran will hold talks with the US only if it lifts its unilateral sanctions. Speaking to Press TV, they also stressed that Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the US removes its sanctions. Such a stance was the theme of the remarks made by Iran's leader during a speech last month. Ayatollah Khamenei also said during his February speech that Iran will never bow down to US pressure over its nuclear program and could enrich uranium up to 60% purity if the country needed it. He, however, reiterated that the Islamic Republic will never seek nukes. Now, as Iranian officials say the ball is in the US court on whether it wants to continue the so-called maximum pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse the course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Said Mostafa Hoshesh, who's a political analyst who joins us from Tehran. Said Mostafa Hoshesh, welcome. Lots of news on the Iran nuclear deal, no surprise there. However, many of it is either fake news or it's just propaganda. So let me first ask you about how people are assuming that there are talks going on between the U.S. and Iran. And, of course, the question, are there talks going on between the two?
Hello, Khabib, and thanks for having me. Well, just mentioned before the package, the report was displayed, you mentioned something about the military option. There is no path between the nuclear deal and the military option. As a matter of fact, if military option was a choice, they would have attacked Iran more than 15 years ago when they attacked Afghanistan and Iraq, and later the Pentagon plans leaked years later to the media revealed that they meant to push seven countries into chaos and disorder, including Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, and Sudan through the military option, and they did it to all those six countries, but Iran was never among those because Iran had already worked the deterrent power. So they went for, they were forced to go for a lengthier way to do it, not in a single step, but in multiple steps. That includes first containing Iran's power, and then after they could, if they ever could, if they ever approved to be able to contain Iran, then weaken Iran, and then they might go for the military option. And Tehran is in the know, they know it pretty well, and that's why they have developed their deterrent, military deterrent power. Though, there is no secret about this very fact that they've been speaking about the military threat as an option. That doesn't mean military action. That's just part of the United States containment strategy. This containment strategy, which came after they realized that they cannot attack Iran, works through the carrot and stick policy. On the carrot side, they claim that they are, and they try to convince Iran that they are up for a conflict resolution, and they are up for talks, and they want to end their animosity and the animosity between the two sides, that they want peace and stability in the region. But if you take a look at the multiple agreements between Iran and the United States and the three European states in the past two decades, you would see that Iran has always been in compliance with the terms of the deals that it has struck with its powers, and even in the words of U.S. experts and officials, because Iranian officials believe that they are pursuing the path toward conflict resolution. But the Americans and the Europeans have never been after a conflict resolution. They have never been loyal to the deals that they have struck with Iran because they never intended to resolve the conflicts with Iran over its nuclear industry or any other thing. They wanted a containment to weaken Iran in order to push back Iran, which has grown so powerful that has become a role model for other regional nations, that most of which happen to be under the U.S. hegemonic rule, and this could endanger the U.S. interests in the region. So on the carrot side, They have always done this, but they have never been after a conflict resolution. On the stick side, I try to wrap it up. On the stick side, they've worked on two main pillars of sanctions, and posing credible military threat that I just explained would never end up in action. It's just posed in order to change the calculation among Iranian officials and people, especially in election season, and when they want and when they talk about JCPOA nuclear talks with the United States, so on and so forth. The sanctions so are a weapon of choice for the United States. The sanctions regime carries most of the burden in this formula of containment, the strategy of containment. That's why they play tricks in order to keep the sanctions. Even Obama, that signed the nuclear deal with Iran, he signed removal of the sanctions, nuclear-related sanctions, but he never did that because they feel that they need the sanctions for the next steps. First step is the nuclear deal, and the nuclear deal is not everything. They need to work out other agreements in order to contain Iran's power, and they need the sanctions tool in this strategy.
Okay, well, let me bring in Michael Springman. He is an author and former diplomat from Washington, D.C., who joins us. You know, we've heard about this carrot and stick approach. It's been used, maybe decades now. At this point, as far back as my memory goes, why not, in this case, in point Michael Springman, forget about the carrot and go for another fruit called the lifting of sanctions? I mean, that's where we were at back in 2015 or 14. And if the U.S. does that, from Iran's foreign minister to Iran's leader to you name it, have said, if the U.S. does that, we return to the talks. And it doesn't even have to require a vote of any kind, according to the Iranian foreign minister. Why doesn't the U.S. do that?
Because the United States has opposed Iran since the 1953 with the overthrow of Mossadegh by the CIA and the British Secret Intelligence Service. They then pressed the Iranians after the repulsive Shah was overthrown in 1979, and the United States has looked for ways to control Iran and to ensure that American willpower and American politics and American foreign policy prevail in the region. They, of course, are influenced by that apartheid entity that sells itself Israel. I have no real insight into the Iranian government, and I probably shouldn't have, and shouldn't dictate things to what the Iranians do, but I would think that if the United States simply cannot cancel its sanctions, which it imposed unilaterally, maybe the Iranians could say, well, let's look for a new way of doing things, and we'll talk about a new agreement, provided we include Israel, and Israel's atomic bombs, Israel's poison gas, and Israel's deadly bacteria. Let's have inspections there. Let's have an international body to administer this inspection and to limit the amount of these weapons that the Israelis can possess. So I think that the Americans talk and talk and talk, and they've got this news media that is tame and follows the lead of the American government because they want to keep their connections, because they want to keep their advertisers, and therefore they parrot what the government tells them to parrot. And this is the whole problem. It's a simple thing. They impose the sanctions with a stroke of a pen, and they can remove them with a stroke of a pen, but they don't want to do it because they simply want to destroy Iran and the Iranian people and the Iranian form of government.
Okay, moving on, Mostafa Hoshesh, to this idea of step by step. This has been rotating in the news, a step by step move, something which Iran at this point has rejected outright. For the ones who are asking, why is this being rejected by Iran, what can you tell them?
A very good question. To put it in a nutshell, most of the debates these days is about the same fact. Let me put it this way, that could be understood easily for everyone. As I just explained, the United States is not up for, it doesn't want a conflict resolution over Iran's, for example, nuclear industry. They don't have any concerns about that. Otherwise, they would have stuck to the nuclear deal that provides them with the harshest ever imposed regime of inspections on any nation. So that explains why they have never been happy when the nuclear deal was struck. They were never satisfied with that, and they are asking for more. So to do more, they need their weapon of choice, that's sanctions. Well, at the beginning, in 2015, Obama did it in a deceitful move. He signed removal of the nuclear-related sanctions, but they never did it in practice. So Iran couldn't do SWIFT, Iranian Central Bank couldn't do anything. So he was accused of lying by many, even the camp in Iran that's pro-talks, the negotiators. They all stressed years after that Obama never put it in action. He never removed the sanctions, in practice. Now Washington knows, it's a long time they know, that Iran has learned the game, and it would not be convinced to go for, deals so easily. So they have worked out a different mechanism for the very same deceitful purpose. What have they done? After the U.S. exit of the nuclear deal, they went for an FSW rule that is fortifying sanctions wall. In other words, they copy-pasted the nuclear-related secondary sanctions under a different label, this time, for example, terrorism. Then again, for a third layer, they copy-pasted the same nuclear-related sanctions under a different label. That's called the regional practice of Iran and human rights and other layers of several layers. They have set this wall, they've thickened this wall in different layers. Why? Because they knew that now that Tehran has learned the game and cannot be deceived through the Obama way, if one day they are forced, because they are forced to keep the JCPOA and they know it, the military option is not an option, so their only way is building up on this JCPOA for containing other power components of Iran. So if one day they are forced to remove the nuclear-related sanctions, and they do it even in practice, really, again, the Iranian central bank and economy cannot do a single SWIFT, a single transaction. Why? Because identical regime of sanctions is still in place under a different label called terrorism. Even if Iran struck terrorism or whatever deal with them, and if Washington really removes the terrorism-related sanctions, again, the Iranian Central Bank cannot do anything because it's under similar, identical regime of sanctions under human rights, under its regional role, and so on and so forth. So they have worked out a mechanism in order to deceive Iran. This is in total breach of the nuclear deal contents. Paragraphs 25, 26 mentions that you may not remove the nuclear-related sanctions and reimpose them under a different label or pretext. So what Iran wants, Iran knows this game, and it knows that they want to fool Tehran. So Tehran says, okay, you need to remove all the sanctions. I need to verify and see if you are honest or not, because you have always proved to be dishonest. And we know that Washington wants reciprocal moves because they do not want us to see the end of the game, because they want to say, okay, we do remove just one part, you go for another part. After six, seven, eight phases, you would see that, okay, nuclear-related sanctions maximum have been removed, but still the Iranian Central Bank and Iranian economy is in trouble and cannot do anything. So what they need to do is remove all the sanctions, and Iran should be able to verify it. Otherwise, Tehran will not be fooled at all.
Okay. Michael Springman, I'm sure you've heard of what has hit the news pretty heavily, and I'm going to bring up the name Richard Nephew and ask you about the actions taken by this man who was chosen as Biden's deputy on Iran's file now, and how he has come out in the news taking personal credit for depriving Iranians of food and driving up the unemployment rate in the country, celebrating the economic destruction that he caused as what he called a tremendous success. in which it is said now that he will be helping direct that policy on Iran now with Biden's appointment. Is this a revelation of the true nature of the U.S., that it wants Iranians to suffer?
Yes, indeed. The people that Biden has appointed, like this Neptune fellow and others, are people that have nothing but contempt for the rest of the world, and in particular Iran. You've got this Neera Tanden that Biden wanted to appoint as the director of the budget, and she wanted to have Libya paid for being bombed and to turn its oil over to the United States to pay for the cost of the illegal and unconstitutional war against the country. So this is typical of the American attitude. And Nephew isn't the only one. You've got Blinken, the Secretary of State, who is a Jew and conceivably a Zionist, talking about how Iran continually has to comply with American demands and step by step, tit for tat, we will get around to lifting the sanctions if Iran starts to do things that we want Iran to do and not what Iran itself wants to do. The American government has tried for decades to destroy the country. I've been there, and it's a wonderful country, filled with very helpful, very pleasant people. And granted, it was 3 years ago, but it was still functioning then. There were tremendous traffic jams. There were goods in the shops. I got some fantastic meals and met some really marvelous people, like Nader Talibzadeh. And this is what the Americans don't want the world to know. This is what the Americans want to crush and destroy, because it gives a lie to their statements publicly and privately about the evils of Iran and how Iran is a terrorist state, when it fails to look at itself as a terrorist state, when it fails to look at the apartheid entity of Israel as a terrorist state, or Saudi Arabia as a terrorist state, and the Gulf Cooperation Council, which it set up with all those repressive and repulsive medieval monarchies on the Red Sea there. So it's, yes, the Nephew is the true face of American policy towards Iran.
Okay. My final question to you, Mustafa Pashtesh. This was quite a telling scene when the picture came out of how it showed you have Israeli jets escorting U.S. B-52 bombers, which carry nuclear weapons, amid the tensions that are going on, and, of course, the possibilities of Iran and the U.S. maybe working out something. I mean, first of all, what signal does that send, and what impression is Iran supposed to get, who's pursuing a civilian nuclear program but is being sent a message by a U.S. B-52 bomber that carries nuclear weapons?
Kaveh, in this formula contained in, half of the job is done through posing credible military threat without any action, as I said. It's a professional poker player bluff, actually. If there was any doubt among Iranians, they realized it last year after triple incidents in the Persian Gulf, after the shooting down of the U.S. Global Harbor Triton, as well as the Iranian missile strike on Ain al-Assad, which when Donald Trump had already warned that he would reciprocate it with bombing 52 cultural centers in Iran, a very vivid and strong threat. But he never did any action. He was the U.S. president. He was a warmonger, but he never took any action. It was proof that the U.S. military threats are not credible. But still, they insist on that. They would not give it up. So they are trying to project Israel as a complementary threat. That's why their media, the Israeli media, American media, are filled with so many lies about sabotage, bombing Iranians in Syria and elsewhere. Yes, they did the sabotage at Natanz. They assassinated Dr. Fakhrizadeh. True, they would receive a harsh revenge, as Iran has already promised. But they are too weak to claim so many attacks that all have proved to be lies,
right?
Because they very much calculate on posing threat to the Iranian public. They believe that if they pose a serious threat,
okay,
the Israelis and Americans, then they can change the minds of Iranian officials and their calculations, as well as the Iranian public in the election season.
Okay.
So Tehran believes that Israel is too shaky to represent any kind of threat, but still, military is the military, and they would not ignore any kind of threat, so the Israeli officials like Netanyahu, they need to watch the words.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're unfortunately out of time. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mostafa Fashesh, political analyst, and thank you very much, Michael Springman, author and former diplomat, that is, from Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale, my entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyah, and then later they were moved to Najaf, and he studied in Najaf. And according to the teachers that we have heard from our teachers or the resources that we had, they have said like he became mujtahid at the age of 16, and he had the ijazah from Ayatollah Khoi.
When we look at his scientific activities, his scholarly books, we see that all of his ideas come from a very established foundation. And that systematic, planned, programmed system can also be observed and manifested in his political and social activities.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher and analysis on the thoughts, theories, and works of the most outstanding Muslim thinkers all across the nation of Islam. With me in the studio are two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Zazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. We want to discuss one of the most important theories of Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, titled as Mantiqatul Faraq. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. And Dr. Rezazadeh, assalamu alaikum, brother, welcome to
the show. Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, good to be here.
So in our last episode, we give our dear listeners a background and introductory remarks regarding the concept of Mantiqatul Faraq. We can say, as Sayyid Mohsen defined it, it is a scope of domain of religion in which the Islamic ruler has free hand or free powers in order to issue rulings based on the necessities and the circumstances of the day. Dr. Zazadeh, I have a question for you. This idea of the Mantiqatul Faraq of Shahid al-Sadr is criticized by some of the people who are, we can say, very much linked to the fixed rulings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and Islamic rulings on earth, okay?
Right.
But at the same time, I think the idea of Mantiqatul Faraq can establish a kind of dialogue between different denominations inside the religion of Islam too, mainly the Shia and the Sunni one. I mean, it brings a kind of a scope of discussion, debate, and exchanging the ideas between different scholars of the Muslim lands between them. So if they discuss them, I think they can find the better answer to the questions of the Muslims in today's world, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, that's right. You know, in many different aspects, that's the case, especially in today's world, because we are living in a world that we are facing modernity, and modernity has a lot of new requirements and implications, and it also requires us to talk more about the new things. And the idea of Mantiqatul Faraq is mostly applicable at the modern time, because of course it has been something that has existed from the beginning of the history of Islam, according to what Shahid Sadr says. Even the Prophet of Islam used that free area in order to give rulings that are more applicable to the new situation that happened. But naturally, it is much more necessary to have this idea at the modern time, which we are facing a much faster trend in the area of the, you know, everything changes on a daily basis.
Changing, that's right.
So so in this situation, we need to be faster in giving more proper answers.
Yes.
And in order to give better
answers. And sorry, different doubts and questions are coming to the Dafatar of Maraje, also for example, the office of Ayatollah Khamenei, every day new questions comes up. on this, on that.
You know, if you want to count the number of the new examples of the things that has emerged in the modern time, you cannot even count them because
the tricks are more nowadays. Yeah. That's right.
It's better and to some answer the question as well. What was the fatwa so the listeners can?
Yes. Okay. I will get for the answer to you, Sayyid Mohsen. Okay. Now you go on with the new developments.
And some of the things that may sound to be very, you know, something very simple in modern world, but they never existed in the past. For example, banking system, insurance, you know, artificial insemination, and you know these things like that that have become part of the today's world, especially banking as a very major
human cloning
example,
for example. Yes,
all of these things need let's say somehow rulings. When a Muslim wants to have have an Islamic lifestyle, they want answers for these questions. These are just some simple questions, simple examples. But in order to have good answers to these, we need a type of communications and relationships and discussions among the scholars, not only within the one Islamic denominations, but also within different schools and with different denominations. For example, our Sunni brothers have the concept of maqasid al-sharia, which maybe we can translate it as objectives of the religion, something. In the Shia, the scholars have looked differently into the issue of objectives of the religion. They don't accept it in the same way. But still, we have something similar to that in the ideas of many different scholars, including Shahid Saad himself. For instance, he says that at the time of the Prophet, we have a hadith that said, "Man ahya mawatan fahiya lah." If a person revives a dead land, you know, a dead land in a land that has nothing in it, if a person goes and revives it and makes it into a garden or a farm or something, that land would be for him. Mm-hmm. So he will be the owner of that land. So the Prophet actually gave a type of ownership. This is a method of owning a land. And that was in place for many centuries. But in today's world, Shahid Saad, he says, if we look at the idea and the goal behind the rulings of Islam, this cannot work anymore. Because in the modern time, a person can just start, you know, by using new methods and new machines.
That's right.
A person can revive maybe
thousands of lands
for himself, and that can make problems for the society. So he said that ruling cannot be applied in today's world.
Okay.
So why is he saying that? Because he knows that this is one of the examples of that free area that is in the hand of the juries to say if it is applicable today or not.
Okay. And Hakim al-Islami or the Muslim ruler.
Exactly.
The Council
and
of the
finding
Muslim.
These examples and many other examples need a lot of discussions and communications between the scholars and between not only the jurists, but also between the scholars of fiqh and also the experts of other sciences.
Other sciences. This is very important. That's right. So what's your idea, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, now? How the concept of Mantaqatul Faragh can establish dialogue between denominations inside? Because we know that, for example, the scholars of our Sunni brethren have their own powers of deductions and, we can say, rulings. Issuing the rulings, new laws according to the societies. And is this Mantaqatul Faragh very much limited to the geography and the culture and the society? Because we have different Muslims. I mean, the Muslim living in Africa is very different from Asia or Indonesia or Iran.
It can be. It can be. Obviously, this Mantaqatul Faragh, obviously, the way it was defined, it is like according to the situations, different situations, the leader can give different rulings, can issue different rulings. And it depends on the situations that you have. Maybe in Africa there are other situations. Okay. People who are living there is a specific ruling for them. Mm-hmm. Maybe there is no taxation, for example.
Yes.
Or maybe where their people are living in a rich area, there is a taxation for them.
Okay.
By the government. Now, when we talk about the government or giving the taxation, tax itself does not have any Islamic, we can say, existence. Islamically, texts do not exist.
Okay.
But according to Mantaqatul Faragh, the Islamic ruler can take texts from the people.
Yes.
He can issue the ruling that, for example, these people who have this much earning, they should pay this much of taxation.
Okay.
Apart from the zakat and khums that they have.
Yes.
There's something extra.
Okay.
It's a new ruling, and it's wajib on them. to do that. On top of that, if I can give you a couple of more examples in regards to the use of mandaqatul faraq in the economics, one is the taxation. The other thing is, you know, some people they hoard or store the things or the, you know, the
goods.
The goods.
Hoarding the goods.
Hoarding the goods, that's and right. Then later they sell it for more price.
Yes.
Now, sometimes the government...
During pandemic COVID-19, this was very much now.
This was happening.
Yeah.
Now, a ruler, an Islamic ruler, according to the Mantaqatul Faragh, the area of Mantaqatul Faragh, if they find someone, a place, a store where there was the goods were hoarded...
Yes.
He can take all of that under his own custody and bring them to the market and give them a price.
Oh.
It's under his power. Maybe he can announce that these all should be sold under the price,
okay,
or maybe for a specific price.
Okay.
It is in the hands of the Islamic, we can say, ruler. Mm-hmm. And it comes under the Mandaqatul Faragh.
That's right.
Basically, obviously, there is a price over there. He should technically sell it for that specific price which is on there. But he can sell it under the price or over the price. Definitely. It depends on him. There is another example we can say, like we have mawqufat al-amma.
Mm-hmm.
Mawqufat, it means like...
Public endowments.
Public endowments.
That's right.
In the case that there is someone like who has a specific place or anything which is waqf, for example, and then he does not make someone or anyone... as a guardian or...
As a custody or inheritor
that's of right. that place.
Yes.
Now, this thing, who should basically become the inheritor? Mm-hmm. The question is, the fuqaha, and generally it is said the hakim, the ruler, will become the inheritor.
Mm-hmm.
It also comes under his hand. He has a free hand in this to do whatever he wants to do with that. So there are different cases where we can practically see that practically, we are in the society are applying the rule of Mandaqatul Faragh, but we don't know about the terminology.
Yes.
Shahid Saad came and he introduced this terminology.
Yes, organized this
and
thought.
He gave these examples. He said, like, the things that you're doing at the moment, the things that you're doing, it all comes under the same category, under the same terminology which has been introduced as Mandaqatul Faragh.
Mandaqatul Faragh. The unfortunate news is that nowadays we can see some scholars who use this kind of power, but the things that they say is in complete contradiction with the fixed rulings that was issued.
Well,
and unfortunately, because they say new things, they attract many people toward themselves because all of a sudden the ruling is changed. Maybe the ruling is easier, the ruling is applicable in more cases, or it is, I don't want to say it is haram, but it is not halal. It is halal, haram, like, okay, half between.
It's a mix between good things and bad things.
And bad and things.
The way that
and, you know, it is like walking on the edge of the razor. It's very sharp. You know,
one thing which we should not forget is when we were talking about the Mandaqatul Faragh, we were saying, like, there is an area where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala did not issue any rulings. Mm-hmm. There is no rulings. There is no existence of any ruling.
Okay.
And in that place, this free hand is given to the ruler of the Muslim Ummah.
Yes.
For the goodness of the society, he can make new laws and new rules.
That's all right.
But where there we have some rulings, for example, riba is haram.
Yes.
Intrust is haram. Usury and intrust, obviously, these are two definitions. If I can talk like according to the economics. Generally, when you look at the dictionary, usury is said like if you take something extra.
Yes.
If government has basically issued an announcement or a notice that whoever takes loan, he has to pay, for example, 5% of interest. Mm-hmm. If someone takes more than that from someone by giving the loan from the borrower, if he takes more than that, it is usury. But if he takes 5%, it is allowable. It is interest.
Okay.
According to Islam, anything that you take on top of loan is haram. It's riba.
Yes.
Not even 5%, not even 0.1%. Okay? Now, according to the way you just said, unfortunately, when the banking system came to Egypt, the scholars in Egypt, they gave fatwa that the interest is halal and the usury is haram, the way it has been defined in the dictionaries.
Yes.
So basically, they made somehow interest, which is riba halal, and they said, like, it's under the authority of the government.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Better to apply it or not?
Yes.
Okay.
The point is where we have clear statements that this thing is haram and halal, there a faqih, a mujtahid, cannot come and interpret.
Okay.
He cannot do that.
Yes.
Especially where there is a clear statement by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
We call it legitimate deception. Dr. Azadeh, do you have any point?
I think
because this is our final program regarding mantaqat al-faragh.
Yeah, I think it is more precise to say that mantaqat al-faragh is not necessarily only for the places that there is no ruling.
Mm-hmm.
It is also for the places that there is a ruling, but that ruling does not have a fixed nature.
Mm-hmm.
Because there aren't rulings that by nature they are dynamic. There are rulings that by nature they are changeable.
That's right.
Mantaqat al-faragh also comes there.
Yes.
And that's very important.
Very good.
The other point that I wanted to say is that in addition to this important concept of mantaqat al-faragh, we have large number of the hadith that they talk about al-ijtihad bil-ra'i, that is
ijtihad based on own reasoning.
Arbitrary issuing opinion on something,
okay,
which is baseless, which is not based on.
Uh-huh.
So we need to have a comprehensive idea. It's not, yes, the case that anyone think that, okay, we have mantaqat al-faragh, so whenever,
yes,
something new happens, we can use that as,
okay,
a new method to
yes,
just escape from the Islamic ruling. No,
yes,
that's not the case.
Okay.
It needs the expertise of the faqih and the jurists,
yes,
to have in mind, to consider all the different,
yes,
conditions of that,
yes,
and then issue the final opinion.
That's
of
right.
Something.
That's right, but it shows the dynamism of this idea,
yes, of course,
of Shahid al-Sadr and how the religion, I mean, which is revealed to Prophet Muhammad 1,400 years ago, can still be applicable in today's life.
Yeah.
It very much depends on your power of deduction, how to apply it, and how to be faithful to the fixed obligations of your religion. This is very important, okay? Sometimes we forget the roots and we can't say harvest the fruits.
Yeah.
This is wrong. We can't say fruits without strong roots are not possible. Thank you very much, Dr. Rezazadeh.
You're
and
Sayyid
Mohsen Naqvi for your,
yeah,
presence in the program. The teacher, we discussed the idea and the theory of mantaqat al-faragh presented by Shahid Muhammad Baqir Assad in his book Iqtisaduna. It was very kind of you, dear listeners, to listen to us today. Visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam Radio, also a YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The world with reporters.
The coronavirus pandemic in Iran is now past its third peak. but a new wave of the virus is feared to be gripping the country, with some southern areas witnessing a surge in infections and fatalities. That has left hospitals, especially in the southwestern province of Khuzestan, short of beds. Now, to make up for the bed shortage in the worst affected areas, the headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order, which is an entity affiliated with the leader of the Islamic Revolution, has launched mobile hospital, which is fully equipped and ready to be deployed to the target zones.
The mobile hospital has all the necessary equipment to serve as a super specialty hospital in the less privileged areas and the hardest hit zones during the pandemic. The 500-bed hospital is connected to a telemedicine network and can use the facilities of other hospitals if necessary.
The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order has been at the forefront of efforts to fight the pandemic in Iran. Its main focus has been on developing a domestic COVID vaccine. The jab, called Coviran, is now at its second human trial stage. Three other Iranian entities are also developing their own vaccines.
We have reached the capability to produce COVID vaccines based on all the platforms that are existing today, such as mRNA, vector, attenuated virus, recombinant proteins, etc. We are facing the U.S. sanctions that prevent other countries from selling us their vaccines, so we have had to rely on our own resources. The process is a bit lengthy, but we hope to be able to get a local vaccine to the market in a matter of 5 months.
Nearly 1.7 million people in Iran have so far caught the virus. Over 60,000 of them have succumbed to the disease. As Iranian vaccines are yet to make their way to the market, authorities are importing foreign-made jabs, such as Russia's Sputnik V, to inoculate people. So far, Moscow has dispatched three vaccine consignments, topping 320,000 doses. Iran has also imported another 250,000 vaccine doses from China. Experts say the pandemic is outpacing the vaccination program, and for now, early diagnosis and medication is still the only way to contain the virus. The headquarters for the execution of Imam Khomeini's order says it's also speeding up efforts to get its vaccine to the mass production stage as soon as possible. But it says developing the infrastructure for COVID patients is still a high priority, since the fight against the coronavirus is still far from over. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Heartbreaking scenes are appearing from Jammu region of Indian administered Kashmir after authorities launched a drive against illegal immigrants in the region. Authorities are going makeshift to makeshift, collecting biometrics and other details of Rohingya refugees. The drive is a part of an exercise to trace foreigners living without valid documents. According to official records, so far 168 immigrant Rohingyas have been detained due to lack of documentation.
They have taken my husband and now they are not allowing us to see each other. I don't know why we are unwanted everywhere. We've been facing worse times back home and now here also. Why is the world silent on our plight? Is it because we are Muslims or because of our race or our color?
Calling it a conspiracy to alter the demographic character of Hindu-dominated Jammu region, the political parties and social organizations there have urged the government of India to immediately deport the Muslim Rohingya refugees and other nationals.
On the basis of humanitarian grounds, we have given space to these refugees, but now the numbers are soaring and it's a matter of concern. It will have impact on our safety and security. The aim of BJP government is to deport them back to Myanmar.
Fearing detention, now many families are leaving the refugee camps and moving to unknown destinations.
We have lifelong seen separation. We separated when we left our homes in Myanmar. And for a while, we were together again at refugee camps in Bangladesh. There also, we were forced to run for life. We came to India and now we are again on the same path of running for our lives. We don't want to witness separation. Let us live or kill us, but do not separate us from our loved ones.
According to official records, 13,700 foreigners, including Rohingya Muslims and Bangladeshi nationals, are settled in the Jammu region, where their population has almost doubled between 2006 and 2016. According to the United Nations, Rohingyas, an ethnic Muslim minority group, is the world's most persecuted minority. The community has faced institutionalized discrimination, such as denial of citizenship in Myanmar, predominantly Buddhist country, and is denied movement, state education, and civil service jobs.
Thousands of Rohingya refugees have fled their homes after facing exodus at the hands of Buddhist authorities. But till day, the world has failed to secure the future of this community, who are now living in a constant fear of deportation in the scattered parts of the world, like Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Bangladesh, and India. Shahana Bhatt from the Jammu region of Indian administered Kashmir.
How the EU deals with crises was the subject of scathing criticism during a debate on the bloc's health systems in the European Parliament. There were major failings when COVID-19 began to wreak havoc in Italy 13 months ago, and now the EU's vaccine strategy is being described as a fiasco.
Ci sta chiedendo perché.
Citizens are wondering why we are not rolling out the Chinese, Russian or Cuban vaccines. Perhaps it's because the European Union has decided to give more importance to relations with the US instead of saving thousands of people.
The death toll from COVID-19 in the 27-country EU is approaching 550,000.
The pandemic exposed the vulnerability of our healthcare systems as we experienced care disruptions, medical shortages, health system inadequacy, insufficient and unequal access to healthcare.
Instead of improving during the course of the pandemic, apparently the situation is getting worse.
Some of these inequalities are widening, not only across countries, but also across population groups within each country.
One clear example of inequality was highlighted during the debate. Statistics show a person in intensive care with COVID-19 in Luxembourg has a 65% chance of survival. In fellow EU nation Romania, it's just 25%. Some legislators say the EU's poor handling of successive crises has dangerous political consequences, and experts agree.
We're seeing the rise of the far right across Europe, and this is not just far right, not right, just right-wing populism. This is naked racism. This is neo-fascism.
The EU Commissioner for Health, Stella Kariakides, has told lawmakers that lessons have been learned the hard way due to the coronavirus.
Indeed, we're determined to respond in a way that looks to the future and develops concrete benefits and protection to the citizens.
Legislators have just passed a €5.1 billion budget for a program called EU for Health. However, they are well aware that reforms don't happen overnight when it comes to the EU project. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma, and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeidah and LBB have stopped their operations, and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country. International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A cry for help for France's more than 3 million Muslims. A letter of complaint signed by a global coalition of 25 civil society organizations and NGOs spanning 11 countries to the President of the European Commission, urging immediate action against France for what they call is its state-sponsored Islamophobia. Renamed the Charter of Principles, the Imam Charter's 10 articles set out the so-called Republican values to which all imams in France should subscribe. Either you're with the Republic, the French president has warned, or you're not with the Republic.
What Macron is trying to do is feed into a narrative that Muslims is a cultural threat to France. And really, the reality is that France, the vast majority of French Muslims are law-abiding citizens. They've been arising social, economically in French society, and that is a concern and a threat to the French elite.
The new letter of complaint follows a similar one in January by a coalition of Muslim NGOs to the UN Human Rights Council. The already existing problem of French Islamophobia took a turn for the worse in the wake of the beheading of school teacher Samuel Paty by a Takfiri extremist outside his school in November last year for showing offensive cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad during his class. For the French president, that provided a valuable opportunity. He defended the profane cartoons and introduced legislation targeting so-called Islamic extremism.
So this is entirely cynical. He's using this for political gain. And the reality is, as soon as you start conceding room to the far right, then that normalizes them. So I wouldn't be surprised if he actually loses votes.
The deeply offensive caricatures set off angry protests worldwide. But inside France, a crackdown on the Muslim community. Multiple mosques were forced to close. The country's biggest Muslim charity and an anti-Islamophobia organization were banned. Dozens of people were arrested, and hundreds face deportation. Critics say the recent moves by the French state target Muslims and alienates them, and the French government's attempt at aligning French Islam with Republican values and to combat separatism raises more questions than answers. Saeed Kouriza, London.
The U.S. and South Korea began joint command post exercises Monday, which plan to run through March 18th. The controversial drills draw opposition from peace groups in South Korea and around the world. COVID-19 restrictions prevented more people from gathering outside the South Korean presidential office. But they made their point.
We have to pay attention to the U.S. emphasis on fight tonight, which means South Korea and the U.S. military training is to maintain combat readiness. We must think again on this point of combat readiness. What is the purpose of fight tonight? Who is it going to protect?
Activists in Seoul don't think the drills offer South Koreans protection.
We oppose the drill because it's not for the protection of the South Korea, but is illegal training for the protection of the U.S. mainland and U.S. military bases in the Indo-Pacific area.
South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff said the drills would be scaled back, quote, comprehensively taking into consideration the COVID-19 situation, the maintenance of the combat readiness posture, the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and the establishment of peace. But some experts expect some type of provocation from North Korea in response to the exercises, as Pyongyang views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion. U.S. President Joseph Biden's new administration has said it's reviewing its policy toward North Korea in consultation with its allies. Just as the U.S.-South Korea military exercises are scheduled to wrap up, sources say U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin will arrive here in Seoul for talks with their South Korean counterparts. North Korea policy should figure high on the agenda for those conversations. Frank Smith, Seoul.
All over France, demonstrations took place on the 8th of March, the International Women's Day. In hospitals, supermarkets, schools, and nurseries, most of the employees are women. The COVID-related lockdowns and curfews had a huge impact on them. Their working conditions are getting worse. A group of cleaning women working for a huge hotel chain in Paris are in strike for almost 2 years. The COVID does not improve their situation.
Because of the COVID, the boss said he would pay us, but he did not pay us at all. He said, because of the COVID, I cannot pay you. So in fact, the COVID has become a pretext for making profit on the back of the workers. The COVID arrived on a bad moment. I believe it benefits much more to the bosses and not at us, the workers.
According to a 2020 report of INSEE, the French National Institute for Statistics, women in France are paid 23% less than men. In many sectors, such as healthcare, retail, and cleanup, the work had to be maintained during the lockdown. And 8 over 10 employees in these sectors are women.
The COVID led to an overload of work because they have to clean door handles, for example, what they did not have to do before. Housemaids also go from one working place to another, which increases the possibility of contamination. But they continue assuring the work very seriously. We do not understand that their salaries are not increased.
The INSEE report also shows that the sectors where mostly women work were the most requested during the COVID crisis. The employees there had to work much more hours, and they had a high incidence of illnesses directly related to their working conditions.
The working conditions were already catastrophic before the COVID crisis, and it's getting worse. The French policies have not changed. They continue to diminish the number of hospital beds.
And if this was already not enough, it is also proven that the COVID crisis has increased the domestic violence against women.
Many women are fighting in the front line against the COVID pandemic, at work and at home. These protesters are demanding better and direct measures from the French government. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Hundreds of medical workers have gathered in front of the United Nations office in the capital Sana'a. They denounced the international community for turning a blind eye on the continued seizure of oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition, which has put the war-torn country to a severe fuel crisis.
I suffer from kidney failure and I have to travel 50 kilometers to get to the dialysis center despite the lack of fuel. I need dialysis 3 times a week, but I only get 1 because of the blockade on our country. We call on the international organizations to stand by our side and help us to get the fuel in order to save our lives.
The Ministry of Health said over 1,500 medical facilities, including dialysis centers, are on the verge of total shutdown due to the lack of fuel. The ministry has urged the international community to step in and pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the seized oil tankers.
Blocking oil vessels from entering the country threatens to stop many health facilities. There are more than 1,500 health centers and 400 laboratories and blood banks on the verge of closure. Centers that generate oxygen may also stop. The lives of patients may end within days. Patients with kidney problems are the most affected. There are more than 5,000 patients who need dialysis several times a week.
The United Nations says the Saudi war on Yemen, along with the years-long blockade, has driven the country into the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Thousands of patients, including children, may lose their lives within days unless the international community breaks its silence and pressures Saudi Arabia to release the illegally detained oil vessels. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
About turning innovative ideas into practice. Toward Stars is the title of this exhibition, which puts on display the latest technologies that are made in Iran. A whole range of high-tech products, from mapping drones to smart medical equipment, are showcased here. Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, hailed the Iranian tech companies for helping to keep the national industries afloat amid foreign pressures.
In spite of the unilateral sanctions on our country, we have been able to serve our needs by tapping into our domestic resources and young minds. Technological development builds power and makes us independent from foreign powers. When a nation is independent, no other country can exert pressure on it.
The event was inspired by remarks made by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, in August last year, where he put emphasis on the need to focus on science-based production and avoid exporting raw material and bulk goods, such as saffron. Given the fact that Iran produces 90% of the world's saffron, this Iranian producer has launched the so-called OSEC. It might sound music to the ears, since it rhymes with OPEC. Only the letter S stands for saffron. The Organization of Saffron Exporting Countries now is an established entity comprising 10 member states, with the goal to organize the global market.